From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
On Tuesday, there is the primary in Washington, D.C., and we hope to do well there. We will then meet with Secretary Clinton on Tuesday night.
That was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on Sunday at a press conference in Vermont. He was asked about his plans moving forward to the Democratic Convention in July in Philadelphia.
Okay. Senator, question. Okay. Following the vote on Tuesday, will you still consider yourself a candidate for the presidency?
We are taking this campaign and our ideas for a strong platform to transform the Democratic Party away from a party which spends far too much time raising money from wealthy people into a party which represents the grassroots of this country. Are we going to take our campaign for transforming the Democratic Party into the convention? Absolutely. Are we going to take our desire and our belief that the Congress of the United States and the government of the United States has got to work for all of us and not just the wealthy into the convention? Absolutely, we are. So, you know, that is what we will be doing.
Senator Sanders?
One last question.
Senator Sanders, quickly. Senator Sanders.
President Obama has...
The convention?
Pardon me?
You said you're going to take your campaign to transform the Democratic Party to the convention, but are you going to take your candidacy for president to the convention?
Well, we are going to take our campaign to the convention with the full understanding that we're very good in arithmetic. And that we know, who has received the most votes up to now.
In an interview Sunday with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, the Democratic hopeful seemed to back off from his platform to accommodate Clinton at some point in the future, particularly on health care and education.
Let's be concrete about this. What kind of things do you need to see exactly?
We need to make sure, in one way or another, that every American has health care as a right, and we join the rest of the industrialized world. That public colleges and universities, again, in one way or another, she may disagree with me as to how we get there, but that public colleges and universities are tuition free. That we create a massive federal jobs program to put millions of people back to work, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. And George, the recognition that climate change is the great global environmental crisis that we face, we've got to work with the world aggressively to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to sustainable energy and energy efficiency.
Sanders also appeared to be carving out space to endorse a Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren ticket.
Are you interested in serving as vice president?
Well, I think that is very unlikely, but, you know, we will see what happens after this whole campaign winds down. What I want to see is Hillary Clinton appoint a vice president who is a progressive. I want to see Hillary Clinton become a champion of the needs of working families, putting together an administration not based on Wall Street's needs, but on the needs of ordinary Americans.
So if not you, Elizabeth Warren?
Well, I'm a great admirer of Elizabeth Warren. She has been a dynamite senator and has stood up to Wall Street her entire political life.
We'll have more on the Democratic primary with a look at some 2 million missing votes. More than 40% of those cast as of Monday have still not been counted in California. We'll take a close look at that later in this newscast. The Council on American Islamic Relations, a leading U.S. Muslim advocacy group, strongly condemned the deadly shooting in Orlando this past weekend that took 50 lives and pointed out that, despite the media's characterization of the incident, Muslims were not to blame for what it called a hate crime. Press TV's Sansom Sears filed this report.
It's been described as the worst shooting incident in U.S. history. A gunman opened fire inside a gay club in Orlando, killing scores of people. President Barack Obama described the shooting as an act of terror and hate.
Although it's still early in the investigation, we know enough to say that this was an act of terror and an act of hate. And as Americans, we are united in grief in outrage, and in resolve to defend our people.
The gunman has been identified as Omar Sadiqi Mateen, a U.S. citizen of Afghan descent. The ISIL group has claimed responsibility for the bloodshed. Reports say Mateen swore allegiance to Daesh before the shooting. Yet U.S. officials say there's no immediate evidence that the terrorist group was behind the massacre. The Muslim community in the U.S. has condemned the shooting, saying it has nothing to do with Islam. The community also warned against attempts to exploit the incident against Muslims.
And to those politicians who may try to exploit this tragedy, we ask them to respect the victims and their families. This is not the time to score points. This is not the time to exploit fear.
Meanwhile, FBI officials say Mateen was twice questioned before Saturday's shooting. However, they failed to detain him due to what they described as lack of concrete evidence. This is not the first mass shooting in the U.S. Powerful gun lobbies and lax gun laws are blamed for the death of thousands of U.S. civilians every year. It also appears that the U.S. security apparatus is unable or unwilling to crack down on the shooting suspects.
On Sunday, San Francisco University professor Stephen Zunes pointed out some of the contradictions in U.S. law that allow such weapons as were used in the attack to come into the hands of people likely to use them.
The United States has very weak gun laws. Indeed, you can be barred for flying on an airplane and not even being given an explanation or a right to appeal or even know what the charges are against you. And yet, the same person on that terrorist watch list can walk into a gun store and get a semi-automatic rifle and copious amounts of ammunition. And so, and we are seeing one of the tragic results of this kind of distorted policy.
The attack in Florida was condemned by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, as Matthew Wells reports.
The UN chief Ban Ki-moon was unequivocal in his description of the attack in the city of Orlando, Florida, in the early hours of Sunday. In a statement issued by his spokesperson, he described it as an horrific attack and extended his deepest condolences to the families of the victims. He also expressed his solidarity with the government and people of the United States. News reports say that at least 50 were killed and more than 50 injured when a heavily armed gunman took hostages inside a nightclub that was described as being popular with the LGBT community. Matthew Wells, United Nations.
An increase in global tensions as NATO announced more troops are headed for Russia's borders. NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg made the announcement during a press conference Monday, a day ahead of a meeting of the alliance's defense ministers in Brussels that opens Tuesday. Stoltenberg said the decision will send a clear message that NATO stands ready to defend all of its allies.
Good afternoon. In less than 4 weeks, we will meet in Warsaw for our summit. And the summit takes place at the defining moment for our security. NATO has taken robust action to protect our nations and to contribute to the stability in our neighborhood. But the challenges we face are enduring, so we need to be prepared for the long haul. Over the next 2 days, NATO defense ministers will pave the way for decisions we will take at the Warsaw summit. First, we will bolster our deterrence and defense across the alliance against threats from any direction. In February, we agreed to enhance our forward presence in the eastern part of the alliance. We are now discussing the size, the scope, and the composition of that force. Based on the advice of our military planners, we will agree to deploy by rotation 4 robust multinational battalions in the Baltic states and in Poland. This will send a clear signal that NATO stands ready to defend any ally. But of course, our defense and deterrence does not rely on just 4 battalions. These are part of a much bigger shift in our posture in response to the challenges we face. We have tripled the size of the NATO response force to 40,000 troops. We have put up a new spearhead force at its core, around 5,000 troops ready to move within days. And we have set up 8 new small headquarters in the eastern part of our alliance to coordinate planning, exercises, and reinforcements. There will also be more pre-positioned equipment and supplies. Altogether, this strikes the right balance between greater ability to reinforce and to boost to our forward and a boost to our forward presence. We have also taken action to so that our troops can move faster across Europe for exercises and reinforcement if needed. National governments and parliaments have worked very hard to update procedures and remove hurdles. And we have made significant progress. Last month, the Spearhead Force conducted an exercise which showed how far we have come. 1,000 troops and 400 military vehicles moved from Spain to Poland within 4 days. We will continue to work to improve freedom of movement for our troops and equipment, because when a crisis emerges, speed can make a difference. So we have boosted our forces and increased our speed. But to sustain this shift, we must also spend more on our defense. 2 years ago, our nations made a pledge to stop defense cuts, increase defense spending, and move towards our benchmark of investing 2% of GDP in defense within a decade. On the spending front, the news is mixed. But today, we have some good news. I'm able to share with you our final figures for 2015 and our estimates for 2016. After the end of the Cold War, there was a long decline in defense spending across European allies and Canada. 2015 was the first after many years when we saw a small increase in defense spending. And you can see that from the slide. And our estimates for 2016 show a further increase. These are only estimates, but they are encouraging. The annual real change stands at around 1.5%, an increase of over $3 billion. 20 allies plan to spend more on defense in real terms this year. So this is real progress. After many years of going in the wrong direction, we are starting to go into the right direction. I will report on this to ministers and at the summit in Warsaw. But we are still far from where we need to be, and we clearly need to do more, both to increase the level of defense spending towards 2% and to spend on the priorities we have identified as an alliance. Second, we will focus on projecting stability beyond our borders by supporting our neighbors and partners, because a stable neighborhood will help to keep us safe. At our ministerial meeting, we will discuss how we can expand our efforts to strengthen local forces, enabling them to stabilize their own countries and fight terrorism, for instance, in Iraq. We will also consider providing AWACS surveillance planes to support the global coalition to counter ISIL. And we will assess what more NATO could do in the wider Mediterranean Sea. For instance, in support of the European Union's Operation Sophia. Our cooperation is providing effective, our cooperation is proving very effective in the Aegean, where NATO ships contribute to cutting the lines of human smuggling. We will discuss the future of our cooperation and the cooperation between NATO and the European Union, together with High Representative Mogherini and ministers from Finland and Sweden. Projecting stability is equally important in our eastern neighborhood, so we will explore additional assistance for Ukraine and Georgia. On Wednesday, we will meet the Ukrainian defense minister in the NATO-Ukraine Commission. We are concerned about the security situation amid continued ceasefire violations in eastern Ukraine. We will also discuss the pace of Ukraine's reforms and the support provided by NATO. So over the next 2 days, we will take a series of important decisions to strengthen our collective defense and enhance our cooperation with partners.
Tensions between NATO and Russia escalated following the 2014 coup in Ukraine. NATO members, particularly the U.S., accused Moscow of supporting militias in eastern Ukraine. The Kremlin denies the claim, saying that the alliance is using it as a pretext to expand to its borders. Although the California Secretary of State declared Hillary Clinton the winner of last Tuesday's primary, a declaration that had the media making wall-to-wall pronouncements that Clinton was now the presumptive nominee, as of Monday, almost a week later, some 2 million votes, or more than 40% of the total cast, had not yet been counted. Mark Sovel and Nick Zechevic hosted the Lip TV newscast TLN this past Friday and discussed what was then 2.5 million missing votes in California's primary.
When Bernie Sanders spoke to the press at the White House, he ended his statement by saying something about the final vote in California. What exactly did he mean by that? This is what he said. I look forward to the full counting of the votes in California, which I suspect will show a much closer vote than the current vote tally. Why did he say that? And what exactly did he mean? Well, it turns out, Nick, that there are still now 2.5 million uncounted votes in California, 700,000 of which were provisional ballots, still uncounted. I'm confused by that because when I look up the results of what was the election results in California, here's a graphic that comes up when I search it on Google. 100% reporting, that means everything's been counted. Hillary has 940,000 votes. Sanders has 1,502,000 votes. All right, that's 100% reporting, right?
Right.
That can't be wrong, right? It's out there.
It's
on Google.
It's Google.
Well, it turns out that actually 2.5 million votes have yet to be counted. That means the difference between the two candidates as it set on the night of the election was around 480,000 votes. That was the difference there. Pretty big difference. And, you know, let's call this for Hillary Clinton. It's a done deal. Well, as it turns out, there's still 2.5 million votes to count. Now, why is it that they haven't counted the votes yet?
Why?
Well, they've called the election. Why bother counting the votes?
You know, we've already moved on to California. We're talking about California. Let's not forget, like, if you look back, this isn't the first time it's happened. They still haven't even counted Puerto Rico either. And and she was also declared the winner there. So this seems to just be the way that they do it.
It's disheartening. Now, I know you don't want to cry over spilled milk. Hillary has been declared the candidate. But there's a lot of people who are very upset, very frustrated, because they feel like their vote didn't matter. Now, for months here, we sat here and said, all these people are saying, when's Bernie going to drop out? We just kept saying, why don't you let everybody vote first and then count the votes and whoever wins, wins. Just let's do that.
Giving the guy for staying in the race until the end.
How dare he?
How dare he do
everybody
something
to get to vote? So then here we get to the you know, last big day and the largest state in the union. And apparently, well, they went through the process of having an election, but didn't bother counting the votes. And these numbers, by the way, are from the state of California's own website. They put it out there in a way so that you can very clearly see, here's how many people voted, here's how many we haven't counted yet. In California, according to the state of California, there were 3,442,000 votes counted so far. Not counted, 2,586,000. That means 42% of the vote in California has not been counted.
As of press time Tuesday, there were still 2 million votes that were not yet counted, according to the California Board of Elections website. Aside from the uncounted votes, California, like most other states, uses voting machines that are not transparent and that rely on proprietary software to tally the vote. Bob Fitrakis is a lawyer who specializes in election law issues. He's also a professor of political science in his home state of Ohio. He was in California with a group of election law experts just prior to the California primary last week and laid out some of the problems with the way votes are counted.
I just recently testified before the Congressional Black Caucus, and the only person who's really got it there over the years was John Conyers, who helped us tremendously. But my opening remarks were simple. If you allow private, partisan, for-profit companies to secretly count your vote with proprietary software, you must want it hacked. What we have created, and I say this, right, it's a faith-based system. It is push and pray. There is no way to verify it. And when some, you know, like I have a PhD in political science as well, that's how I make my money. So when I state the obvious, we have a non-transparent system, why does that make me a conspiracy theorist as opposed to a realist, right? I'm an international election observer. I went down to El Salvador after the revolution. I went down there and I went to the conflictive zone where the Mano Blanco was, where the guerrillas were, and we negotiated an agreement. They could agree on one thing. We want a see-through box. We want to see everyone put the ballot in. And with that, we want a see-through box. We want the ballots in. We want them open before the world, before the UN observers, before the international election observers, before the media, because we don't trust each other. Had I been there, and Urena said it's not a problem, we've hired some right-wing desk squad, they're now in IT, they'll be secretly counting the vote with proprietary software. Well, software, I would have saved time. I would have said presumption of fraud.
That's right.
That is the basis of our system today.
Yes.
Is that, and who are these companies?
It's like
Seidel, that's from Barcelona, Spain. It's counting our vote. What else does it do? Well, its CEO helps negotiate deals between Titan and buying up L7. You remember Titan? They were in Abu Ghraib with khaki torturing people, their employees raping youth, underage youth, and getting away with it.
Wow.
That, you know, Boulderton Capital, Vulcan Capital. Boulderton is tied to British intelligence. What do they own? When I look at this company, Seidel, they own Carrier IQ. That's the third-party app on your phone that spies on you. That turns your video camera on and turns your recorder on. And what do they want mobile applications. Shouldn't we be voting on the phone? We've got an app to make it safe. But we also own Carrier IQ, which spies on everything. So, on a basic level, I'm stunned that at this point in history that they can get away with this. Here's my theory, right? If you trace it back, that which they used to do covertly in the Third World, which is one of our Jim Crows, the secret stealing of elections, they overtly have brought to the United States. And you're seeing it in this election more than any time in history, right? Those of you who follow that. 24 of the first 26 primaries have a shift to Hillary Clinton. But in 11 of them, the shift is so fundamentally large, if we look at the unadjusted exit polls, that they're statistically impossible. You're talking about the one in a billion, right? Our State Department has manuals, and through the AID, the Agency on International Development, if Hillary Clinton had those victories outside U.S. territory, we would say they're under investigation for fraud by AID standards. The same way we challenged Putin's election and the Ukraine election, is that 11 of these are so statistically far out of line, they would not be accepted for our government anywhere in the world. We can't let this stand. We've got to demand full transparency. What does Jimmy Carter say about this? He's been asked, why don't you observe American elections?
Yes.
They're non-transparent. What did he tell Der Spiegel? Yes. He said America does not have a functioning democracy.
Right.
Harvard and the University of Australia at Sydney rated us 47th out of 47th. I know there's certain Republicans that raise the slogan, why not the worst? But I think in our assumption, we can demand full transparency in elections. Yeah. And we can bring these issues forward. We got words, right? One of my favorite words is recalibration. What the hell does that mean? Well, the computer was recording wrong, right? Yeah. Or it was flipping votes. Yeah. So we use these nice terms. Well, we recalibrated it. Oh, well, that's nice. At least it wasn't flipping votes. Yes, it was. That's what recalibration means, you know? And you've seen this over and over again. Look at a company like Seidel, which bought up SOE, right? In 2012, it was able to directly input into the central tabulators in 36 states. It was an honor system. They promised not to mess around. And no matter how close they are in interactions with Booz Allen Hamilton or investment from the Carlyle Group, it's a trust system, and they wouldn't do anything to interfere with our elections. So on the one hand, we have this tremendous amount of statistics, and I'm a social scientist here, indicating someone's tampering with our election. On the other hand, when people raise the issue, they cause the C word. It's like, again, does it make sense that Hillary Clinton keeps winning the Super Lotto, the Classic Lotto, the Powerball, the Pick 5, the Pick 4, and the Pick 3, 11 times in one election cycle?
Absolutely.
I think it needs to be investigated, and that's what we should be doing.
Well, the first thing I want to say is, mandate my ass. Because it seems as though we've been convinced that 26% of the registered voters, not even 26% of the American people, but 26% of the registered voters form a mandate or a landslide. 21% voted for Skippy and 3-4% voted for somebody else who might have been running. But oh yeah, I remember in this year that we have now declared the year from Shogun to Reagan, I remember what I said about Reagan. Minute. Acted like an actor. Hollywood. Acted like a liberal, acted like General Franco when he acted like governor of California, then he acted like a Republican, then he acted like somebody was going to vote for him for president. And now we act like 26% of the registered voters is actually a mandate. We all acted in this, I suppose.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.